what is money, right? Like, what is money itself? And if you have a efficient payment rails like it is in the United States, and the dollar doesn't steal from you enough, you will never ask that question, right? So what I see in Americans is they seek Bitcoin for speculative reasons versus what I see in Venezuela. They seek Bitcoin out of necessity, which is a much stronger incentive than speculation.
You're listening to Because of Bitcoin, a podcast that shares the personal stories of how Bitcoin is having a real impact in people's lives, including mine. I'm your host, Mauricio Di Bartolomeo, the co-founder and CSO of Ledin. And without further ado, let's get started with today's story. Fiat currency, or what most of us know as money today, is managed by bureaucrats. Who decides how much you pay for your mortgage? A group of white-haired dudes in Washington. Who decides what's the right amount of inflation? The same group of white-haired dudes in Washington. When any person or group has that kind of power, corruption and greed eventually take over, and they turn money into a political weapon to help a particular group of people achieve their goals. Do you want the economy to do well leading up to your election date? You can engineer that. Don't like a country that holds your country's bonds? You can cancel their bonds. We're so used to the political money we use today that we have a hard time envisioning what a world could look like with a different kind of money. What if our money was managed by code that everyone could see, instead of having decisions made by politicians behind closed doors in Washington? Bitcoiners have an innate curiosity that drove us to ask why. Why are these things happening to me? Why have we allowed the government to control this much of our financial lives? Why aren't more people asking these questions? This leads us to seek out the answers. And once you understand how political money really works, it makes you want to throw up and never use it again. Education is key to help people find the light, especially when it comes to people who grew up with working money and working governments. For them, it's much harder to see how the movie ends. For people that grew up with broken money, like me, the concept of Bitcoin just clicked. Being able to change someone's perspective is hard work, and Nico Moran is no stranger to this. Nico is the creator and host of Simply Bitcoin, the most watched Bitcoin-only daily live show at the moment. His mission is to guide individuals in claiming back their full financial sovereignty through Bitcoin. In this interview, we discussed everything from political influence on money to the challenges he faces as an educator. It was a blast to catch up with him, and I'm sure you'll love this chat with him as much as I did. Long overdue chat. How are you?
Yo, what's up, man? Happy to be here. excited. Me and you haven't talked in a minute. Glad that you reached out, and thanks for inviting me, man.
Hey, anytime, dude. You have a great story and you're doing some great work for Bitcoin. So we will get into that in a second. The way I like to start the show is asking people about their childhood. So what was life like for young Nico?
It was interesting, man. I had a very interesting childhood. I was born in Europe, actually, to two Venezuelan parents. And I was born in a country where it's not like the US, where if you're born in the US, you get the passport. So one of the first things I had to do, you know, and at the time I only had a Venezuelan passport, is I had to get a visa, right? And it was interesting growing up in Europe, and I would spend also a lot of time in Venezuela. So that's why I still kind of have my accent and I still know the language. And around 8 to 10 years old, I moved to Miami, and this is really where I was raised. But the thing about Miami is, it's Latin America in the United States, right? So everyone is Hispanic. And if you go to certain places in Miami, they only speak Spanish. It was an interesting experience, but it also opened my eyes to not only a different cultures, but a different perspective. And I think specifically in the United States, there's a world outside of the United States, and that world thinks very, very differently. And that world exists and it's there. And that's not a bad thing. If you happen to be born in the US, right, is, you know, this is an American-centric world. I think a lot of people forget that. I was very blessed. My dad was work, and this is part of the reason that he left Venezuela. He was a pretty successful entrepreneur, tech, believe it or not, right? You don't hear that very often from Venezuelans, but he was a pretty successful tech entrepreneur in the 90s. And it was basically to pursue business in Europe. It wasn't really for seeking opportunity or whatnot. And then I think he kind of gave me the entrepreneurial bug a little bit. But of course, your children are always different. So I think I wanted to follow in my dad's like kind of business mindset, but I really, really fell in love with media. And of course, you fall in love with Bitcoin. You try to do what you love, because if you do what you love, then it's not really work every day, you know, and you kind of find yourself in this position where you're like, I got paid for this? This is crazy.
It's surreal. And I agree with you. I think life's a vacation if you do what you love. I've always said that. So finances, it seems, was not necessarily a massive part of the conversation in your household. I find that the two themes that kind of send people almost immediately to Bitcoin are, I had, you know, finance was a big thing in my household. We, you know, everything was about money. Or there's this other set of experiences, which is issues around property rights. Your family lost everything around a banking collapse. Your property was taken away. So it seems like finances was sort of not a big point of conversation.
In my childhood, it was not, right? However, the 2008 financial crisis led to a series of events where my dad's a very profitable business and, you know, I grew up in a very privileged environment. All of that disappeared by the time I was 18. My parents divorced and I went from growing up, you're going to understand this term, en una cuna de oro, to being in a position, which English translation, by the way, translates a golden crib, to being in a position where I was working a minimum wage job. I hit rock bottom. I lost a lot of the friends that I interacted with. You know how shallow the city of Miami is, right? And I had to start from zero. From 18 to 23, I was working minimum wage jobs, got into real estate. And it was only until I had a cousin who came to visit me from Venezuela. And at the time I was sleeping at my friend's house, like literally on the couch. And I was like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, have these magic internet machines in Venezuela, you know, and they're making, you know, they're making money. And I was like, holy cow. At that point, I was so desperate. I hated my life so much that I sold everything I had, borrowed money from my mom, borrowed money from my ex-girlfriend, got on a plane, went to Venezuela. I begged my uncle for a job. He said, I'm not going to pay you, but I'll teach you everything that I know. That was my first exposure to Bitcoin. I was 2016. I was 23 or 24 years old.
That you were, we were mining at the same time, man, in Venezuela. That was actually when my youngest brother.
That was the best time.
It was incredible. It was amazing. Incredible. So that was right around the time when my brother basically did the same thing. He went up to my dad. He said, I'm leaving the house if you don't support my Bitcoin mining efforts. Bitcoin, nobody knew what Bitcoin was. Like, I need to plug in these machines today. And that prompted my dad to send me the white paper. I read the white paper. I didn't really get it the right then and there, but I saw inputs are subsidized power and subsidized internet, and outputs are a good that could be sold for dollars, which nothing could be sold for dollars in Venezuela at the time. You know this. It was printing dollars. It was a dollar printing machine.
For free.
The way when you saw people's eyes light up, you could feel it. You could feel where this was going. When your friend told you about Bitcoin, was your initial draw to it that the fact that they could print money and then you wanted to understand how they did that? Or did you go into it with a thinking of what happened to my dad in 2008 won't happen to somebody that's living under a Bitcoin standard? Because you are very much a principled Bitcoiner. At least that's how I interpret or how I perceive you. How did you go from being interested about the financial opportunity to then it becoming what you wanted to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. Pure desperation. I hated my life at the time and I saw it as an opportunity. I saw it as a way out. So I came for the riches. I stayed for the revolution. So once I started learning more about it and you start following down the rabbit hole, then you start connecting the dots, right? And I was already pretty jaded from what happened during the financial crisis. And a lot of politics around it. It was just like kind of messed up. And we're seeing that unravel now, right? You're seeing essentially getting lectured, you know, the US government giving us lectures about regulations and all that stuff. And I'm like, you guys know that you're sending hundreds of billions of dollars overseas to fund some, you know what I'm saying? And it's like clearly we're in this like weird phase right now where is actually a quote by Solzhenitsyn, which is, you know, they're lying, we know they're lying, and they're lying anyway. And I think we're in this like kind of fourth turning type of event right now, but essentially I first experienced that back then. So I already was jaded back then. Now it's falling apart. So when things started to unravel in 2015, 2016, and my friends were like, holy, this is crazy. I'm like, yeah, welcome. Welcome. I've been here already. I came for the wealth. I came for the greed. That opened my eyes. And I think my prior experience, what happened to my parents in between 2008 and 2010, already had me very, very skeptical of not only the money, but also the political system itself, right? So I was already primed for it. So when it came, I was like, obviously, duh, you know, I don't really have a lot of faith in what these people have to say in the first place. So I never really believed, you know, the excuses. And now we're starting to see that just completely disintegrate.
This concept of they're lying and we know they're lying, I feel has been around for centuries. And there seems to be a critical mass of people that cannot be deprogrammed and keep voting for this stuff over and over. And you're in the media and you're in education. Your job is to deprogram these people. Do you feel like we are doing this at a fast enough clip?
Yeah, so that is one of the biggest obstacles, which is breaking the Bitcoin echo chamber. How do we get to a point? You know, my girlfriend, my wife, who was then my girlfriend, had one of the most astute observations ever. And she's like, Nico, I get it. It's the best money ever. It's sound. It's going to work. But people are stupid. Right. And I was like, holy cow. And then you compare it to not only Venezuela, but like, let's say just my no coiner friends or my normie friends. They're still living in the fiat matrix, right? You know, that meme of like, you tell that guy, like all the stuff that's happening, he's cooking on a grill and he's like, that's cool. Did you see the game on Sunday? Right. So I think we have a model in front of us of what it takes in order for people to actually vote for change. And look at what happened in Argentina with Javier being elected, right? All you really need is 150, 160%. And then people change. Now, what is the fundamental problem? Like, what is the issue? The issue is, as long as governments have a money printer, they can essentially, what it boils down to, very simple, like to the very fundamental level, they can buy votes, right? And as long as you have one party that is willing to buy votes and the other party that's not willing to buy votes, right? There's where the erosion comes from and will inevitably lead to this system of, if you are not, you're not incentivized to vote against that. If the person on TV, you know, it's like 100% propaganda, but if he might be stealing $100 out of your back pocket, but you're not seeing that, you're seeing the $5 he's giving to you from the front, right? And I think human beings don't understand that. They don't understand that money can exist without decreasing in purchasing power. They don't understand that nothing is free. When they're offering free college, it's not free college. It's not only coming out of your tax revenues, but that's not enough tax revenues to fund all the stuff they're promising. That's coming out of debasing your money. And people don't understand that. The thing is, though, is that I think over time, Bitcoin's incentives are so strong. And you're seeing this. You're seeing this not only with the ETF, but there was a Reuters article that came out covering what happened in China. And essentially the article was like, Chinese stock market tanks, the Chinese people are fleeing to Bitcoin, right? So even in the most totalitarian country on the face of the planet, where they not only ban Bitcoin mining, they also ban Bitcoin. People are not only mining Bitcoin, but they're still using Bitcoin as is. So like, to answer your initial question, dude, shit just needs to break to the point where people are just suffering enough for them to like call for change.
It can be disheartening when pain and suffering become the catalysts for change. Although it is sad, pain drives change. In Venezuela, many of us reached a breaking point where we had so little left to lose that risking it all for a chance of a better future made sense. This is what drove many of us in Latin America to start mining Bitcoin. like my family and Nico did in Venezuela. It was the same driving force that led us to migrate to the US, Europe, or Canada, leaving behind our families, the people that raised us, and our country that we love. Bitcoin's been a game changer, empowering individuals seeking for better money. And I've seen people go from zero to all in on Bitcoin in a matter of days. However, I have also seen others who were reluctant to take Bitcoin seriously, because their current system has not failed them, yet. This is why education is so important. To understand Bitcoin, you must understand the consequences and shortcomings of our current political money. The journey to Bitcoin is very different when you're coming at it from necessity versus when you're coming at it from intellectual curiosity. As someone with such a big following, I wanted to know more about Nico's approach to educating such a broad spectrum of listeners. What do you think are the biggest differences when you try to teach Bitcoin to a Latino versus somebody that is, you know, spend most of their lives in the US?
A Venezuelan will get it like this. A American will question it. They'll be skeptical of it. You know, they've had the privilege of being, they've had the financial privilege of growing up in a country that has a relatively stable fiat currency that doesn't steal from them enough for them to question what is money. And I think it boils down to what is money, right? Like, what is money itself? And if you have a efficient payment rails like it is in the United States, and the dollar doesn't steal from you enough, you will never ask that currency. You will never ask that question, right? So what I see in Americans is they seek Bitcoin for speculative reasons versus what I see in Venezuela. They seek Bitcoin out of necessity, which is a much stronger incentive than speculation.
It's funny because you've described it in the very same way that I do, which is Venezuelans get to it out of necessity. They stay because of convenience.
which is true.
It's true. And I think, you know, you're one of these critical thinking Bitcoiners that I can pose this question to because you've experienced the practical realities of this, which is this concept of the appreciation that Latin America has for the US dollar, the acceptance and the liquidity that there is for the US dollar, and frankly, the love that exists for the US dollar down in Latin America. And being that inflation is such a, and money is such a hard concept to get across, it's not surprising to me to see how Latin America and the world at large has sort of embraced stablecoins, right? And I think this concept of being against stablecoins is very much a privileged North American Bitcoiner view of the world, because it's not something that someone that has had a conversation with someone in a favela or has frankly tried to import or sent a wire, you know, as a non-American, you just haven't experienced this. I would love to hear your thoughts around stablecoins, because in my view, they are a great tool.
Yeah, so, and it's a very good point and it's a very interesting topic. And I'll give a little bit of context. So as the Bitcoiner would want all over the world, it's like all these fiat currencies are failing and you're like, Bitcoin adoption. No. What's being adopted is Tether, right? And a small percentage of that alternative local currency is Bitcoin, but that tends to be for the wealthy, right? But for the vast majority of people, they're using USDT, they're using Tether. Now, I don't know why that's happening in Southeast Asia and you know, and that, but I'll speak from the Latin American centric view, from the Latin American perspective. A dollar, even though it's not the official currency in, you know, a handful like Panama, El Salvador, a handful of countries, you can pay in dollars anywhere in Latin America. If you pull out $5, if you pull out $10, if you pull out $100, it is like handing over a bar of gold, right? That's how they view it. That's literally how it is, right? So there's like an ideology, a cult to dollars, and they really like, it's like you look up to it and you're like, this is the fucking dollar. Like, this is, I curse and I apologize, but this is good. This is good currency, but that's compared to what they have locally, right? So my view with Tether is that it is a great stepping stone to using an alternative system than their local system, and also seeing and feeling the conveniences of being able to send that anywhere around the world at a snap of a finger. I think over time, as Bitcoin does its thing, as it continues to grow in market cap and the volatility starts to decrease, right? And it starts to become very obvious that not only is Bitcoin the superior asset, but the superior currency, I think eventually people are going to start to learn, okay, this is Bitcoin. Now, all that being said, the base layer is very expensive. It's going to be very expensive. Second layer solutions on Bitcoin right now are not that great. Like Lightning, cool, but it's not there yet, right? Liquid, great, but it's not enough for Bitcoin to be this, you know, worldwide currency. So I tend to agree with you that it is an extremely elitist, privileged take for you to say, hey, you know, why they not, you know, why they not adopting Bitcoin versus adopting something like Tether. I don't mind paying $5 a transaction, $3 a transaction. You know how much $5 is, you know, from someone in Latin America, specifically if you live in a like a low income country, that's a lot of money, right? So yeah, I think it's super elitist. It's super privileged. And it honestly, it you know, it doesn't make sense to me. It almost makes me as angry as when Nayib Bukele was elected. And a lot of people are like, this guy is a threat to civil liberties and civil rights. And I'm like, so let me get this straight. You were born and you live and you were raised in the wealthiest country on planet Earth. And you are essentially judging how a Latin American leader who was duly elected by the vast majority of the population is running his business in his country, and you have a problem with that. I have the same feeling when people say, oh, you know, stablecoins this, stablecoins that. Same reaction, right? I think it's a stepping stone. Obviously, Bitcoin is the only true money. Obviously, Bitcoin is the best currency. But to think that people are not going to use something like Tether is absolutely naive, and you're just not from the region. That's not to say I'd much rather want people using Bitcoin, but that's not the reality.
No, and that's a very fair point. And I'm actually, it's a very mature view. I bring this up because I know that different Bitcoiners feel different ways. And I've had this cover. I had Bitcoiners ask me questioning why we were supporting stablecoins when we were supporting stablecoins at Ledin, which was the only other asset we added after Bitcoin. And I remember going back to them and saying, what do you mean? Like, have you been down there? Like, have you tried to pay somebody down there? Like, have you tried to explain Bitcoin to somebody down there and see if they get it? And to your point, most people got it. I was there in 2016. People in Venezuela weren't reading Andreas Antonopoulos' book or Saifedean's The Bitcoin Standard and going to local Bitcoins screaming freedom like Braveheart to buy, you know, their P2P Bitcoin. That's not how it was happening. How it was happening is you were getting paid on a Friday. You were calling your dollar broker and saying, I desperately need to get rid of these bolivares. And they were telling you, no one's dumb enough to sell you dollars for bolivares. I got none. I'm sorry. And then they would, and then you would ask, I can't keep these things. What can you sell me? And they would say, I have this thing called Bitcoin. And if you had offered somebody a stablecoin at that time, their answer might have been different. And again, you know, I think it's really important to understand how people are getting into Bitcoin and why, so that we can build the right education materials or the right products or tools to get them there calmly and to get them into Bitcoin in a sort of at their own pace and at their own rhythm. Now, as I mentioned to you earlier, one of the biggest challenges I find when I'm telling people about Bitcoin is I find that if somebody doesn't get inflation and where inflation comes from, it's very hard to explain Bitcoin to them. And so I almost find that I have to teach myself, I find myself teaching people what money is or how inflation works before I have to tell them about Bitcoin. So what have been some of the biggest challenges that you have found trying to educate people, whether you want to talk about people in North America or South America?
Yeah, I think the most effective way of orange pilling someone is planting a seed and then letting number go up, do its thing. And then coming back to the seed that you planted many, many years earlier, and then being like, wait, I should have listened to him. This thing has like doubled or tripled or quadrupled, like WTF. That has been the most effective way. And then in terms of breaking the Bitcoin echo chamber, it's very, very difficult. Not only with my channel, but I was at Swan Bitcoin for a year and I led their YouTube initiative and just like their content strategy overall. And the reality is that just, you know, getting people to care is very difficult. And you essentially have to like clickbait them in a way or incentivize them in order to watch the content. Once they've clickbaited and they've watched the content, that's where you actually start talking about, things that matter, right? Things that are actually consequential. And the reality is that human beings, the way that they interpret information is through stories, right? If you tell an overarching story of what is happening in the world around you, people understand it and they build a sense of connection to it, right? So it's really about building a story. I call it narrative trench warfare, right? Because that's really what it is. There is the other narrative, which is I call the party of green, the party of central bank digital currencies, nihilism, slavery, poverty, the nation state model. Let's go to, fund these crazy wars in these places or whatever, versus the orange narrative, which is like things aren't really that bad. You can have a very optimistic future. You can have hope. You can have prosperity. We can all achieve it on a deflationary currency, which is Bitcoin. And so you're constantly fighting the other side and you're constantly bashing. The problem that they have, though, is that we have the truth on our side. So we don't really need to attack them. All we need to do is just like take a flashlight and be like, just put truth on it. And it just unravels by itself. Like it just crumbles, right? So that's my job. It's just like literally every single day they punch, I punch back. And then every single day, more people come on my side and more people leave their side. That's a one-way door. You don't go back.
I absolutely love that explanation. And this is a great segue because we actually never got to the channel, because you told me about mining, Bitcoin in Venezuela, and you went down there and you took a job with your uncle and all this stuff. How was that evolution? So for those that don't know, you run one of the best Bitcoin channels out there, Simply Bitcoin on YouTube. Everybody go check it out and subscribe. What was the genesis of that channel? How was that start of that journey? And how did you decide that's what you wanted to do?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I've always loved YouTube. Like that, I've lived on YouTube. I've loved YouTube. And I've always wanted to start a YouTube channel since, I was in my early 20s, but I did a calculation in my head when I was like 22, 23, because the reality is that it like literally takes a decade, like for you to succeed on YouTube, for you to like really pop off. It took a lot less than that, but in general, it takes about, 10 years, for you to be like in the stratosphere of like successful YouTubers. And I did a calculation. I was like, I'm 23. If I start a video game channel now, I'm going to be 33. Am I going to be happy being 33 years old talking about video games every day? Like, no. So what I saw is that there was a lot of very successful crypto channels. And I saw a common theme. And that theme was they used clickbait titles and they used very attractive thumbnails in order for people to click. At that time, which was 2020, it was the infancy of Bitcoin-only media. There was no Bitcoin-only content. And I was invited to speak. It was the first time I ever spoke at a Bitcoin conference, at Bitcoin 2021, main stage after Ross Ulbricht's mom like kind of did her, she was talking, they played a recording of Ross Ulbricht and was like getting the chills. And I remember Alex Gladstein being backstage. I was like, I've never done this before. And he looks at me dead in the eye. He's like, not that many people have. And I'm like, holy crap. and then I go on stage and we're just talking. And I think the name of the panel, and I was sitting next to Alex Svetsky, and the name of the panel was like, why Bitcoin maximalism is necessary. And I got to say my bit about Simply Bitcoin. I said, listen, the key is to take the tools and the tactics that a lot of these crypto channels use and apply it to Bitcoin to get people to watch Bitcoin-only channel. To watch Bitcoin-only content. That was the theory. Fast forward 4 years later, I think the theory was successful. I think the theory worked, right? And then I fell in love with media. I fell in love with creating media. I fell in love with creating content, even though there's a lot more money in mining. But I just kind of fell in love with it. And for the first 2 years, I didn't make any money. And anyone who's getting into content, you will not make any money for the first couple of years. You have no idea what you're doing. There's a giant learning curve, like everything in life. And then all of a sudden you start getting sponsors and you start getting, cause you know, you're making sales for them, right? You're getting a lot of eyeballs in this Bitcoin only content. And then all of a sudden you're like, holy cow, this isn't a hobby anymore. This is a business. And then the job offers start to come, right? Of like people that are trying to, you know, grow their media presence. So it was early to when it was like a late 2022 or early, it was late 2022 where Corey reached out. He was like, Nico, help us, you know, grow the Swan channel. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. If you let me keep Simply Bitcoin, keep doing it every day. He's like, yeah, sure. No problem. So I got in there and I literally blew the hell up out of the Swan YouTube channel, realized that I wasn't made to or cut out to work in big corporations, that I like being my own boss. And, you know, I resigned, I think it was 3 weeks ago. And then at that point, Simply Bitcoin was already making enough money where it could support, you know, our team right now is like 10, 12 people, where I was like, okay, you know what, let me just keep doing this. But yeah, man, it's been a crazy journey. It's been a crazy ride. I love to do it, which is why I show up every single day.
You know what? I think a big reason on why your channel has been so popular is the fact that it shows that you love doing this. Like it comes across, genuinely comes across. And I think it's intoxicating. Like it's contagious. Like people see that you love this. And so But on top of, in addition to suggesting everybody to go watch your channel, I just want to say, you know, congrats for the job that you've done and the resilience, because we need more channels like yours. My question also is, you're from, you know, you have Venezuelan parents, you've been around the world, you know that people in places like Venezuela need Bitcoin more than North Americans do, and from sort of practical reasons and philosophical reasons. One of the things I've always wanted to see is more Spanish content. And more content in other languages. Is this something that you are thinking about? How do you feel about this idea of expanding or broadening the reach of educational content?
Yeah, I think it's extremely important because this is a worldwide phenomenon. This is a worldwide movement, right? This isn't just the US. But from a business perspective, right, the English speaking market is the easiest for me to monetize, right? And specifically United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, right? I can go up to sponsors and say, hey, this is whatever. And then that actually allows me to run a business versus kind of Spanish speaking. It's a little bit more niche in that sense. I hope I get to a point where Simply Bitcoin's the size of like, you know, or you can only dream, right? We're like, you know, what Mr. Beast does specifically, like the world's largest YouTuber, is literally he translates his videos into every single, he gets the movie stars of like those countries and he gets them to do the dubs. So when people listen to his videos, it's like, that's Spider-Man, you know, I'm listening to Spider-Man do this video. So it's absolutely genius what he's doing. I would love to get to that point where my business is big enough for it justifies that type of expense, because it's not only Latin America that needs more Spanish speaking content. I'm talking about everywhere. You need this all around the world in every single language. This is something that Saifedean did with his book, The Bitcoin Standard, right? It's very, very important, but You know this because you're a business owner yourself, right? You need to get to a point where that cash flow kind of justifies that expense, right?
I could not agree more. And that's actually the most sincere and genuine answer I've heard to that question. And I think this is what this show is about. We've got to get real about what the limitations are on some of these things and how we can get across them. Like we, for example, when we were getting started, we pro bono for free translated Eric Wall's guide on how to use Bitcoin privately from the Human Rights Foundation for free into Spanish. We need to get to a format that enables the funding of this type of content, because it doesn't produce itself for free, right? And you have to kind of get paid somehow to be able to keep doing this, which is a sad reality about the status of Latin America and as a market, because it seems like, which is a challenge I've had in this industry, is everybody has this ethos of actually banking on bank, and that's what they'll tell you when they meet you. But when you look at where they deploy their money and the things they build, they're not investing in educating anyone in LATAM. They're pulling up iOS 15 apps that require iPhones to run and high bandwidth. They just don't get it. They're not putting their money where their mouth is.
Of course.
And that is a bit frustrating. I agree with you in the fact that it can fix a lot of things about Latin America. I think it's already doing that. What makes you most excited about the future of Bitcoin?
What makes me most excited is the world changing their mindset and their operating system from a inflationary mindset, which brings nihilism, which brings short-term thinking, which brings poverty, to the world switching their operating system and their mindset to a deflationary future, where all of a sudden, even if you are very poor, even if you don't have opportunity, all of a sudden, when you save money, not only does it maintain purchasing power, but it actually increases over time. And that allows you to plan for the future. And I think that if the world wakes up to that reality, the world is going to be a much nicer place. And I think people are going to be a lot friendlier. People are going to be a lot better. It's not going to get rid of human nature, but I would say a lot of those problems that come from despair, nihilism, the short-term type of reaction that is brought on by fiat currencies, that's what I'm excited for. I'm excited for people to start thinking the way that I see the future, because they're going to see it. You've been on a Bitcoin standard, Mauricio. You know what I'm talking about, right? It's just like, it's not, can I afford this thing? Is how long do I have to wait until I'm
when
able
will
to
I buy it?
When will I buy it? And then when you get to it, it's just like, I don't know if I want to buy it, because like, if I wait two more years, it's going to be a lot cheaper. Can you imagine the entire world thinking like that? It would be a much better place for individuals. It'd be a worse place for politicians, bureaucrats, and people that take advantage of that system to enrich themselves.
I remember distinctly when I was growing up, my dad would hear my dad forecast, and my dad would forecast, you know, 2 years out, 1 year out, when he was talking about, when I just overheard conversations in the business. But when inflation started soaring, he would look at business ROIs in weeks and months. And that's what high time preference does. I saw it play out. You no longer build beautiful big things because you don't have the foresight to do so. And if you embark on that with that much unpredictability, you're going to get wrecked. And so nobody starts taking on big things at scale unless you are the government. Anyway, Nico, I'll close with, where can our guests learn more about you? Of course, Simply Bitcoin, but tell us how they can consume all of your content.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at BitVol, and you can search Simply Bitcoin on Twitter, on YouTube, on Rumble, your favorite platform, favorite podcast platform, and you could find us there. We're your number one source for the peaceful Bitcoin revolution. Mauricio, thank you so much for having me on. Really, really appreciate it. Thank you so much for the invite.
I hope that after listening to this episode, you walk away with a better understanding of why Bitcoiners do what we do. And if you're itching to learn more about Bitcoin or about why fiat money sucks, then we've done our job. Nico and his team at Simply Bitcoin work tirelessly every day to expose the shortcomings and consequences of politicized money. The hope is that once listeners find the answers they are looking for, they can opt out of a broken system through Bitcoin. But this task is not easy. We're up against a propaganda apparatus that's designed to tell you, in the middle of the Super Bowl, that you're getting less Doritos for $3.99, not because the government increased the supply of US dollars, making each dollar worth less, but because Frito-Lay is a greedy corporation. Did Frito-Lay also cause the 35% increase in house prices? Did Frito-Lay have something to do with gold and Bitcoin reaching all-time highs? No, they didn't. The value of your assets or commodities is not going up. The value of the US dollar is going down. The most valuable weapon for anyone in pursuit of these answers is education. By arming ourselves with knowledge, we can challenge the status quo and pave the way for a more decentralized and sovereign future. Nico embodies this revolutionary spirit in a way few others can. Through his work, he's guiding individuals to claim back their financial freedom one Satoshi at a time. Go check out Simply Bitcoin and follow Nico on X. We've included the links to all of his content in the show notes. Thank you for joining us today, amigos. Stay curious and stay sovereign. If you enjoyed this Because of Bitcoin episode, I would be very grateful for the 5 seconds it would take you to drop us a review and give us a rating on your favorite podcasting platform. This will really help us reach even more listeners. And if you'd like to learn more about Bitcoin, be sure to check out our newsletter by subscribing at ledn.io. That's ledn.io. Again, this was Mauricio Di Bartolomeo. Stay tuned for our next episode. And until then, muchas gracias y los quiero mucho. Ciao, ciao.